Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston. This episode has a distinct medical theme because we will meet a scientist who is developing a nanophotonic biosensor for diagnosing COVID-19. And we'll also find out what's hot in medical physics from the new editor-in-chief of the journal Physics in Medicine and Biology. And finally, I'll explain how quantum dots could help people avoid allergic reactions to spoiled fish. But first, the January issue of Physics World magazine features an article by Manifa Phillips, who is the first Black woman to be awarded a PhD in physics by Scotland's University of Glasgow. She writes, "I hadn't considered doing a PhD in physics because of how very unlikely a path it was for me, a Black woman educated through British state school education. After completing her doctorate in materials physics, she is now training as a patent attorney. You can read about Phillips' pathway to a career in physics in her article, From Physicist to Patent Attorney, which you can find on the Physics World website." Developing rapid, convenient, and reliable tests for COVID-19 is a crucial task for scientists battling the pandemic. The European Union-funded CONVAT project is creating a nanophotonics biosensor that will detect the virus in human patient samples, as well as in animal reservoirs. I'm joined down the line by CONVAT coordinator Laura Lechuga, who is at the Catalan Institute of Nanoscience and Nanotechnology in Barcelona. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the Physics World Weekly podcast.
Hello, Hamid.
So, Laura, before we talk about the nanophotonics technology behind CONVAT, can you give us an idea of the program itself? Who's involved and where are they based?
Yes, in CONVAT project, we are four partners. So it's not only my group here located in Barcelona, in the sunny Barcelona in Spain, but there is also another partner from the University of Barcelona, also here in Spain. And then we have another partner from the University of Aix-Marseille in France. And the last one is from Rome in Italy, and is one of the National Institute for Infectious Diseases in as I say, in Rome, in Italy.
Now, CONVAT aims to create a point-of-care tool for coronavirus detection using nanophotonics. Can you give us a simple explanation of how this technology will work?
Yes, I mean, this technology is just, you can imagine that you have just a very small device where the light is going inside, and then we just allocate some specific receptor able to recognize the coronavirus. So when the specific receptor recognizes the coronavirus in the sample of a patient, then the light that is traveling in this nanophotonic device is changed, and then we can monitor immediately this very, very tiny change in the light, and then we know that the person is infected with the coronavirus.
Is the idea that the virus itself becomes attached within the optical device, and the fact that it's stuck there changes how the light behaves in the device? Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, that's how the device is working, because we already are using the device in the lab. That's correct. So the light is traveling. It's a visible light, it's red light. And then when the whole virus is attached to our device, then we can see this tiny change in the light at the output of the device. And then we can know if the person is wearing the coronavirus or not.
And what sort of benefits does this technique have over existing coronavirus tests?
Well, this is very similar to the antigen tests that are already on the market and have been widely used just now. But the main advantage is that we can monitor the viral load of a person. This is something that any of the techniques is giving at this moment, but then with our technology, we can know how many viruses has a person. And this is very important. important, especially for the medical doctor, to know if a person has a very low viral load, if you have a high number of viruses. So this is very important. So this is one. And the second advantage is the technology is 100% sensitive. So all the technology, the commercial technology that we have now, especially the antigen tests, they are not 100% sensitive, and our technology will be. And this is also really important because then we can avoid the false positive, false negative.
And it sounds like a simple concept, but I'm guessing that there are some technical challenges that you and your colleagues will have to overcome to create a practical device. What are those challenges, and how do you plan on dealing with them?
Well, I mean, of course, I mean, this is a very sophisticated device because we're using nanophotonics, we're using nanotechnology. So we have to create not only the device itself, but also the way how the light can go into, how we read the light, how we allocate this biological receptor, how we allocate the sample of the patient. So it's complex because we have to mix many different knowledge. We have to mix the knowledge from physics, from engineering, from biology, from the medicine. So this is one of the main challenges because we have to maintain alive the biological receptor while we have to use this light at the nanometer level interacting with the bioreceptor. So it's a sophisticated technology. But on the other hand, I mean, if you are able to surpass all this challenge, then you can supply a device that is 100% specific. And also, as I said before, quantitative. I mean, giving a number, how many viruses you have.
And how would this work on a practical level? Is the idea that you would produce millions and millions of these devices and they would be used once, or could the same device be used over and over again after being, I don't know, cleaned or regenerated?
Well, I mean, when we are speaking about this kind of technology, we imagine like a very small device, I mean, like a portable device, where you can insert your biochip and then you do one measurement, for example, for one patient, you deploy the sample of the patient, and then you get the signal, and then after that, you just throw away the biochip. But the machine, I mean, the small device is going to be always the same. You just only interchange a cartridge for each different patient. Of course, at the laboratory level, we know how to reuse all this cartridge, I mean, all this sensor. But just from now, I mean, because we know in the diagnostic field, we have to use one by one, I mean, for each patient. I mean, we cannot reuse, even if we know how to reuse. It's my vision just now how the device could be used in the practice.
Okay. And how do you test the technology, whether it works? Do you have to use real coronavirus particles? And is that something that's tricky to do?
Yes. Well, when we started this project last year in March, and then we have this problem because we say, okay, we are in a laboratory. Even if we have a biosafety level 2 level here in my lab, we are not able to use the SARS-CoV-2 directly. So what we did was at the beginning, we just contacted with a colleague. He was able to supply us a pseudo virus. So it was a very similar virus, I mean, with the same envelope, but in the interior is a non-infected virus. So we just were doing all the optimization and everything with this non-infective pseudovirus, and then we get very good results, and then we decided then to shift to the SARS-CoV-2. But as you say, we can use this in the lab. And what we did was to use a technique to make inactivate the SARS-CoV-2. We are using a technique by ultraviolet, and then we just inactivate means that we just damage the RNA from the virus, and then it's not infective anymore, but the virus is completely preserved. So now we are using this SARS-CoV-2 in the lab, desactivated, and we are having very good results as well.
Ah, okay, right. And when do you expect to have a device that can be used in clinical settings? I know that it can take a long time for medical devices to be approved. And is it going to take a long time?
Well, so what we're going to do just now, we are finalizing now all the optimization in the lab, and then we are going to translate the device and go to the hospital and then to do the real sample from padding in the hospital. So when we have demonstrated that the device is working and is working well and with 100 sensitivity as we expected, then here then we have to think about how is the technological transfer, because we cannot fabricate a device for commercialization. So we have to contact a company, or a company has to take over all this work and then to commercialize. And here this is the main problem. I mean, how if a company want to commercialize, I guess perhaps we need several months or even 1 year to have this on the market. But it's something that we cannot do the scientists. So the scientists, we can do all the previous work, and we can go like a pre-commercial phase. But of course, the commercialization has to be done by a company.
And could this technology be adapted to test for other diseases?
Yes, of course. I mean, my technology was already developed for other diseases before starting this pandemic. And in fact, when the call for this European project, they were asking for groups that we already have developed the technology for other diseases. In my case, we normally use this technology for the fast detection of infection of bacteria, also in the hospital. And we have use also for the early detection of cancer biomarkers. So the technology was already more or less prepared, no, for different diseases. This is the good thing about this technology. If we make a big effort to commercialize, then we can adapt easily to other diseases. And in my opinion, these point-of-care technologies where you don't need a centralized laboratory, then probably it's going to be the future in the diagnostics. So this is a very promising technology that we can adapt to many different diseases.
Laura and colleagues have published a perspective article on nanophotonics biosensors in the Journal of Physics Photonics. Their paper is open access, and it can be found on the IOP Science website. Just search for the title Nanophotonic Biosensors for Point-of-Care COVID-19 Diagnostics and Coronavirus Surveillance. Thanks for speaking to me, Laura.
So it has been a pleasure to speak to you, Hamish, and I hope that all the people can read our article and then to get more insight about this really exciting technology for the future.
Medical physics is a huge and flourishing field that combines cutting-edge research with crucial clinical roles in healthcare. Physics World's Tammy Freeman caught up with medical physicist Katya Parati, who talks about some hot topics in medical physics and describes some of the radiotherapy research ongoing in her lab in Munich.
I'm speaking today with Katya Parati, Chair of Medical Physics at LMU Munich. Katya has also just taken on the role of Editor-in-Chief of the journal Physics in Medicine and Biology. Hi, Katya.
Hi, Tammy.
Firstly, I wonder if you could give our listeners a quick introduction to the journal Physics in Medicine and Biology, or PMB as we call it.
Yeah, certainly, with pleasure. So PMB is one of the most established journals in the field of medical physics and biomedical engineering. And it has a long tradition, which is dating back to its foundation in 1956. And in fact, we will be celebrating this year 65 years of PMB. And I think that since then, its focus has been really rooted into physics, particularly the development and application of theoretical, computational, and experimental physics to medicine, physiology, and biology, which is also the scope that you can find in the journal. And certainly a major emphasis is on biomedical imaging and therapeutic intervention.
So what do you consider are the key values that PMB brings to the community?
Well, I would say that for the readers, it provides an excellent forum to communicate the best cutting-edge research in the fields. And this has been shown by several examples. I would like to mention in the field of radiation therapy, where I'd say that several of the most influential papers on the development of intensity-modulated radiotherapy were published in PMB, up to the very latest paper, which has been recently awarded the Rotblat Medal on MRI-guided radiotherapy. So this was the paper on the first patient treated with a high field 1.5 Tesla MR Linac. But there are a lot of these examples also in the imaging field. Here I would like, for example, to point out that one of the first new formats, so-called roadmap papers, which are kind of visionary papers saying where the field is going, was in fact dedicated to the challenge towards ultra-fast time of flight PET, so positron emission tomography in the picosecond range, so 10 picosecond challenge. But also for the authors, there are several key values. I would say the most important, I would say it's the very rigorous, fair and quick review process. But I would say there are also additional benefits, like there is no limitation on the number of pages. And there are really several channels to highlight important contribution and also to proper acknowledge and honor their authors.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about, you know, this is a physics journal and it's reporting on new technology developments. But then some of these developments, you know, they make their way into the clinic, like the MR-guided LINAC that you mentioned. And then we get to also report on, you know, the first patient treatments. So it's sort of really, really showing how this technology is bringing real benefit to sort of for clinical applications as well.
Yes, certainly. And this is actually some point that I wanted also to emphasize, because sometimes there is a perception that a paper for being in PMB has really to be just still the fundamental and the initial idea. I mean, it's true that PMB is not meant as the forum for really a more clinical oriented paper. For that, there are a more specialized journal. But I would like to point to this example of this paper, which got also this medal, which is given for the highest cited contribution. Since, as mentioned, PMB hosted in this case really a lot of the for the initial fundamental and the really more experimental works, but really up to the first application in human. And this, I think, it's really a very good example of what the broad scope of PMB can be.
So how do you feel about becoming the editor-in-chief, and what will this role involve for you?
I'm very honored and actually also thrilled to have this opportunity to intensify my commitment to the journal after having already served since 2013 in its board. And this is also the journal where I actually published probably most of my scientific work. So, the task will be to work together with the IOP publishing team and the members of the editorial board, as well as the international advisory board, to further advance the journal. So to see how to continue to give our best services to the authors and to the readership. But we are also constantly evaluating the new trends in the field, trying to keep the scope of the journal up to date. And this has also to be reflected in the update of the profile of the reviewers and the members of these editorial teams. And then, of course, also an important work for the for this position together with these groups is to work on the commissioning of contributions. I was mentioning already this like new formats, these roadmap papers, which have been recently introduced to provide a kind of visionary papers on where the field is going, or topical reviews, or special issues.
Okay, so I mean, can you sort of pick out any key emerging research areas that we should be keeping our eye on?
Oh, well, there are certainly a lot of exciting developments. And since we're saying it's the journal is really rooted in the application of physics, I think there are a lot of new trends in exploitation of physical phenomena for biomedical applications. Like there are a lot of new trends around acoustics or optics. I think you also recently reported in Physics World about Cherenkov imaging. There are certainly a lot of exciting things in nanotechnologies, which can be used both as contrast agents or as radiation sensitizers. There are a lot of activities in special detector developments. I was mentioning earlier this improvement in PET technology toward this challenge of ultra-fast time-of-flight PET, but also in X-ray imaging, there are a lot of exciting developments, for example, with photon counting detectors. There are a lot of efforts to combine modalities, so hybrid detector technologies. In radiation therapy, there are new frontier effects like flash microbeam therapy. And then, of course, in all of this, there is now a huge trend of apply also artificial intelligence for a lot of these application and fields.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've certainly seen a lot of. Do you think AI will sort of really impact the sort of research that people are doing within medical physics?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think so. But this also comes, I think, with a challenge to maintain this rigorous science, because, of course, you can do many things. And then it's also the question for us. I think it will be not the goal of PMB to become the host to development of new artificial intelligence algorithms, but it will be the goal to see how new application of maybe existing algorithm or fine-tuning or existing algorithms could impact what we are doing in this biomedical imaging or therapeutic interventions. And we see already that this is really changing a bit the landscape of how research has been doing and will certainly influence in the end also the practitioners. And so all these developments will certainly be accompanied by clever use of artificial intelligence.
Indeed, yes. So, I mean, you mentioned a new type of article that PMB is going to be publishing. Are there any other future developments that might be coming up for the journal?
Yes, so we are certainly having a lot of ideas that we are discussing in our editorial board meetings. On the one end, we are also trying to reach out and incorporate as early as possible also early career researchers, so the next generation, so to say, of scientists, so to try to engage them at different levels. For example, there should be also a special issue coming soon where a lot of early career researchers will contribute very exciting topics. Then, as I mentioned, we are constantly thinking about topical reviews, special issues, and these new journal formats, which I mentioned, like these roadmap papers. Since the field is becoming more and more interdisciplinary, we are also evaluating whether there could be some synergies also with other journals from IOP, so that we could even think to combine some joint issue for this very interdisciplinary topics. And then, of course, we are constantly seeing how to, as I was saying earlier, improve the experience for our authors and our readers, but also also evaluating different channels to, well, first of all, identify early enough this new research, new emerging areas, and also find ways for disseminating them and also give proper emphasis to impactful contributions which appear in PMB. So as mentioned, we have already many communication channels to broadcast outstanding papers, but we are always looking into opportunity to increase this and also to give special visibility to their authors.
Excellent, thanks. Now, I also wanted to look at some of your own research work at LMU Munich. Much of your group's research focuses on radiation therapies, including several techniques for range verification of particle therapy. Can you explain what these involve?
Yes, particle therapy is probably still an emerging technique in radiation therapy. So, and it comes with the advantage that you can even better target the energy deposition in the tumor. So you can probably better concentrate this dose of the tumor with less side effect to the healthy tissue and critical organs. But this always come with a disadvantage that they are much more sensitive to uncertainty in knowing exactly where the beam will stop in the patient. And this is what we call the problem of range uncertainty. And also here, it's where there are a lot of physics processes that you can try to exploit in order to visualize the stopping position of a beam in the patient, either nuclear reaction processes, which you can visualize with positron emission tomography or prong gamma, so very energetic photons, or there are even emissions which are due to thermoacoustic emission, which are generated by this energy deposition if you are using a pulse beam. And yeah, these are all techniques which require a lot of research from the instrumentation in order to make the instruments compatible with the clinical environment and also sensitive enough to capture this typically very low level of signal. But then also a lot of techniques in order to model the signal or reconstruct the images, and finally also to combine this and integrate in the possible future workflow to, for example, combine with the treatment planning and to evaluate in order to give the clinician some tool to decide whether the treatment was successful or not. And so these are...
Okay, yes. So, I mean, these are all techniques that are used to sort of during proton therapy to sort of monitor where the beam's going and where the energy is being deposited.
Yes, correct. So proton or can be also used for heavier ions. And on top of that, another interesting research area is also to improve the imaging itself of a patient, because one of these uncertainties in knowing where the beam is stopping is also due to our limited knowledge of the properties of a tissue when interacting with a beam. And if you use standard CT imaging, there are relatively large uncertainties, up to 3% of the range. But if you use other techniques, if you, for example, use the emerging dual energy CT, or if you even use the ion itself to make the imaging, so proton or heavy ion imaging, then you can reduce this uncertainty and you can get basically a better information to put in your treatment planning to make a more accurate planning. And this is certainly also another very exciting research.
Okay, are any of these technologies in clinical use yet or near it, or is it still early stage?
I would say that there is a different level of maturity. Some of them, like PET, positron emission tomography for range monitoring, has been already explored clinically already since many years by a few institutions, but without having yet really a commercial prototype, so mostly with research instrumentation. Prong gamma is reaching now the stage of a clinical evaluation, but again, we just first prototype, which maybe still not full exploit the potential of the technique, so there is still more work to even improve this solution. And then other methods, like I was saying, with these thermoacoustics are a bit more still at the development stage, still in phantoms and so on, and not yet. Well, there had been maybe just isolated attempts to evaluate them clinically, but it's really now still going in that direction. And also, as far as proton imaging is concerned, I think a first prototype is probably close to reach the clinical application. So I guess we will see more in the coming years, and we will see which of this technology will then be able to really become a useful tool in a routine application.
Yeah, so lots to look out for.
Yes.
Are there any other interesting technologies under development in your group that you'd like to mention?
Well, we do have a very well-funded project from the European Commission regarding the development of a small animal proton irradiation platform with integrated image guidance. And I think this is really exciting because it has been shown in the last years that if you want to translate to the clinic new therapeutic approach, it's always good to make first experimentation on animals. But to do so, it's even more challenging to make a very precise irradiation of these small targets. And often, especially in the particle therapy community, often the sites where this irradiation were done were not really equipped, neither on the characteristic of a beam to target precisely this small structure, and nor in sense of equipment for image guidance. And so this is, for example, one exciting project where we are developing a platform which is aimed to be portable and be integrated in a research room of a particle therapy facility with some dedicated beam line, which can take the clinical beam and focus actively in order to reach very small targets in the tumor and irradiate precisely. And then a lot of these technologies I was mentioning to make the proton imaging before the treatment, and then integrate this PET and thermoacoustic imaging to verify the range. And also new treatment planning strategies for adaptive therapy.
Okay, so with this small animal platform, basically you can test out some of these new developments, but using a small animal version of what would eventually appear in the clinic.
Yes, this, you could also say like that. But of course, sometimes the technology for animal, it will be, of course, a bit different from the human size, because, of course, you have to scale down everything to very small size. But yeah, you could say also that some of these could be indeed some already evaluation in small animals. And we do hope that since there are now a lot of new trends and new frontiers research on what new effects of biology that could be exploited therapeutically, it would be great to have this kind of platform to support biologists to make really precise experiments to test these new possible effects in order to figure out better approaches which could then translate into hopefully improved clinical treatment.
Excellent. Right. Well, thanks very much. That's really interesting. And thank you for speaking to us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Katia Parodi in conversation with Tammy Freeman. Now it's time for my top tip for what's new in physics research this week. And it's something that proves you can learn something new every day. Did you know that when mackerel, a popular fish for eating, spoils, it gives off histamine, and this compound can cause allergic reactions in some people? Now, it can be difficult to detect when this is happening, because the fish can look and smell okay, but still give off histamine. Now, Tae-jung Park and colleagues at Chung-Ang University in South Korea have come up with a way of using carbon quantum dots to reveal the presence of histamine. The dots are coated with a compound that prevents them from glowing under a UV lamp. But histamine binds to the coating and removes it, allowing the quantum dots to glow. The team says that their new technique is much better than existing methods and could be adapted to detect molecules other than histamine. You can read more on the Physics World website. Just look for the headline, "Quantum Dots Light Up When Fish Have Spoiled." I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's podcast. Thanks to Laura Lechuga, Katia Parodi, and Tammy Freeman for joining me today. And a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. Please join us again next week. Physics World.